Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
This is Wrong Questions of Modern Action Theory. So remember, we started with, let's go, I say before we get this thing, because I tend to think that, I mean, ideas don't interest me that much, even as a philosopher. People do, because I think that ideas have to be attached to people. I have this weird view. So I like seeing people. So when I read books, I care about what they look like, who they are, the history and sort of thing. So you've been talking about Anscombe, but you probably never met her or talked, you know, sort of thing. Even though she was here at the House of Studies, she would have prayed in that chapel. She slept in the Anscombe suite in the front of the house. It's not called the Anscombe suite except by some of us. But so she stayed here, so she was walking these grounds. So it's kind of like a philosopher saint sort of thing. But just so you get a feel for who this person is, just so you can see and like get a sort of thing. If you look over on the screen, that's her as a young woman with Peter Geech. She was married to another philosopher, a great philosopher, Peter Geech, who was kind of overshadowed by her. So it's like Mr. and Mrs. Anscombe. So might have to do a conference at some point. There's them, the young. They had seven kids. They would let them run around Oxford with signs on them that said, "Don't feed me, I'm a Geech." They have there's plenty of stories about Oxford. You can read all of this kind of stuff with seven children, but also full-time philosophers. There's them, of course, later life, which is very nice. That's my favorite, perhaps my favorite picture of her. That's her giving a piece in the University of Navarre in Spain, I think, on human essence, which is in the collection of works, Human Life, Action, Ethics, where she's asked to give a talk on something like human life, and she ends up giving this cool metaphysical or Wittgensteinian reflection on essences and languages. So I'm sure everyone just had no idea what she's talking about. But there she is, with the monocle, all the picture. And then there's down her there with with a cigar. She lived a long time. She lived almost 81 years, right? If I do my math right, 82 years. Which I assume was because of the copious cigars she smoked. But that could be special pleading on my part. Also, it's just nice, we have a video. I just want to show an interview with her, where she's talking about Wittgenstein, actually, her mentor, and what was so great about her. And because you think, like, this woman is just, I mean, whoa, don't be around her. She's like being around Socrates. Like, this is not a good person that's friendly to you, sort of thing. But you hear her and meet her, like, this is a really kind of nice, simple, friendly person. Like, wow. Super great. So let's watch a second of this video here.
Well, I tell you something. He had an extraordinary understanding of why people thought the things that they did think in philosophical argument. So that when he undermined it, his undermining showed that he was getting at the nerve, the root. It was not a superficial refutation. He also was struck by as a great deal more alive than almost anybody else. He also had an amazingly good judgment of what it was sensible to tell somebody to read, what was right for them.
Pleasant. Okay. Now, so just to situate this, last night we started with Modern Moral Philosophy, or essay, or at least the guts of it, of what's wrong with modern moral philosophy, modern ethics, you could say. And the negation there, we want to negate modern ethical theory. That's the claim. It's based on mistakes, this sort of thing, right? And she says, but to do that, we might want, oh, good, we want good ethics. We want to move from bad modern moral ethical theory to good ethics. But you can't do that. That's her claim. Like, we can't just go straight, oh man, we've got bad ethics. Now we need to go to, we'll just replace with good ethics. No, the whole thing has to come out. Like, we have to look at it. That means we need to take a detour, right, to action theory. And she says, look, the reason why we're not getting ethics right, because no one understands what action is. If we look at action, we're going to find out what's really going on, and we need to replace the modern action theory, or account thereof, with the right account of action, right, which is in this book, Intention, which Donald Damon says, Anscombe's Intention is the most important treatment of action since Aristotle. It's a long time. Pretty impressive, okay? So in this book, she's going to talk about what actions are and aren't, and then that's going to give us a sense of what we can do with real ethics. So this talk is the bottom left one, looking at the wrong questions you can ask about action. Last night was the wrong questions you can ask about ethics. Now we're going to look at the wrong about action under that. So then next talk, Dr. Beers can tell us, here's the positive view. So this is via negativa at this moment. Here's the positive view of action. And then the final talk will be, well, okay, if that's what human action is, what's human ethics? Right. That's my extraordinary. So that's the goal, is to go around this sort of thing. You've got to dig under. It's like there's a fence that's blocking us from escaping this modern ethical morass. So we have to dig under it and pop in on the other side. Okay. So as we're looking at Anscombe's intention, we're going to talk about, but I want to start with Wittgenstein, okay, which is an account of, well, this intention business, right? It's a good question to ask. So Wittgenstein is on your hand up. Wittgenstein says, when I raise my arm rises. And now a problem emerges. What is left over if I subtract the fact that my arm rises from the fact that I raise my arm? Are the kinesthetic sensations, like the things happening, are they what willing? He's asking what willing is, what intending is, right? So he says, if I'm thinking about, well, let's see, raise my arm, arm raises, okay. Now, what is it that's different than just an arm rising from raising my arm? So if I, and I can do that by, let's see, if I get rid of the arm rising, what's left over? Right, so that's going to give us like the intention. Now, as you know, or you hope to be noticed, the point of Wittgenstein asking this question is because you're supposed to run into the kind of problematic ways of going forward, and then you're supposed to go, right, this question is a dumb question, nonsensical, and should not be asked. Right? So again, this is the Wittgenstein, he's saying this in his voice, but this is the interlocutor's question. So Wittgenstein is not asking what's left over. This is him saying, now I'm going to ask a stupid question, which doesn't seem stupid initially, but we're going to get to this, right? Now, because Wittgenstein is actually hard to understand, here's an example to respond. This is Robert Chisholm, one of the greatest American philosophers in the 20th century. Brown's philosopher, university, underrepresented here, of course, unfortunately. But maybe this is why, who knows? He writes a review. He writes a review of Anscombe's intention when it comes out, and he starts with the Wittgensteinian question. He says, broadly speaking, there are three possible... So he's going to answer. Wittgenstein says, what left over when I raise my arm? When I get rid of the arm rising and just get the raising of my arm, right? As well, there's three possibilities, right? One is that there's no difference between my arm raising my arm and my arms merely going up, right? The physical fact of it going up and me raising my arm. That's just two ways of saying the same thing. That's one. He says the second possible answer you could give to this is that what distinguishes my raising my arm from my arms merely going up is the fact that when I raise my arm, a certain kind of psychological or physiological, either one, state plays an essential role in raising, causing my arm to go up. So if I get rid of the physical, there's some like state of me that allows the arm to be raised that's different than just the arm being raised from outside, for instance. And the third one is that when I raise my arm, my arm is going up is determined not merely by a certain set of states, so two, right, but by a self who is a kind of prime mover, right, capable of initiating physical causal chains in a way in which no mere set of states or events can initiate any causal chain. So it's like the self in your freedom is kind of like God in creation, ex nihilo, like he's not moving something. He's creating. He's ex nihiloing, right? And you have this kind of transcendental power to do this because you have a self. Now, Roderick Chisholm, when he's reviewing Anscombe's book, using this Wittgensteinian question, assuming it's the right question to ask, says, Miss Anscombe seems to take the second of these courses, but I do not feel certain that she succeeds. To which Anscombe, I assume, would say, you're correct. I have not succeeded. But it's not because I've attempted the second one of these things. The point is to not try to realize that any of these solutions is going to fail. It's the wrong kind of thing. And you don't replace it with a new question. with a new version of that question, a new answer, you replace it with a new question. You get rid of the question of asking this. Okay? But so even smart people like Roger Chisholm can be confused about what Wittgenstein and what Anse comes up to. But the idea is that we're trying to get rid of trying to answer this question. We've got to feel comfortable with that. We can't just, like, stick our heads in the sand and go, whatever. But there, you've got to give a reason why it's the wrong question to ask. Okay. So, what Anscombe does, and this is the question I want you to keep in the background, this is her question, right? That is a question, but it turns out the idea is this is the wrong kind of question you want to ask, I take it. Or at least figuring that out is part of it, part of what is the problem with action theory. What is the description of an intentional action? So if I have an intentional action, that's what we want. We want, because we care about action, we care about human actions. Well, human actions aren't obviously intentional actions. I intend to do something, right? No one really cares about the fact that Newton's law is pushing me up and I'm pushing down. That's not interesting for it. In moral terms, the thing we're looking for is human actions, which are intentional actions, broadly speaking. Okay? So she says, here's a question. What is the description of an intentional action? Like, what is it? It describes them, right? And the problem with this question you want to, as the note says, is that you should think, is there one description of an intentional action? And if there's not, what does that mean about the question about intentional actions? And two, if there is one, where is it? This is Wittgenstein's question, assuming that it's serious. Now, so those that just keep those in the background there, it's on the sheet. So let's look at, let's look at the second one there, the where. So if we're looking for an intentional action, if we're looking for the description of it, we're looking for the intentional action, the intention in the action, where are we to look? Well, there seem to be two options, but they're both bad ways of going about it. But they seem very natural, right? One is that if we're looking for an intention, well, it's got to be something out there, something physical, right? You could think this is the second. So remember Chisholm's, the first one is there's no difference between these physical states and this. Forget that. Transcendental one, ignore that. A second one. It's either a physiological or a psychological state. A physiological state, right? That's where it's going to be. Okay? So this is one way. So the intention is somewhere. It's got to be out there. Some sort of physical description, right? It's not the same thing as raising the hand, but it's got to be something to do with that. All right? And Anscombe says, of course, we have a special interest in human actions, but what is it that we have a special interest in here, in these human actions, right? She says, it is not that we have a special interest in the movement of these molecules. Or think like out there, third person sciencing. Right? Where are we going to look for this thing? Well, if we're looking at human action, do we care about the molecules? No, namely the ones in a human being. Right? Those aren't going to be where we find an intention. Or even in the movements of certain bodies. Right? Like how they move. If we measure them, then we'll find the intention. Right? The intention, we care about molecules and movements, but they're not the right place that we care about for human action. They're involved in it, it's seemingly, let's take the third option, but they're not the kind of thing that is the intention, right? Okay? So one is, if you try to look for intentions in the stuff out there, you just, it seems like you're looking at the wrong place, right? First off. The second thing, okay, so she says, and in describing intentional actions as such, it'll be a mistake to look for the fundamental description of what occurs. Remember, what's the one description? You're supposed to think in your mind, you're going to take this back at some point, right? But okay, as the movement of muscles and molecules, right? And then think of intention as something perhaps very complicated that qualifies this. It's a particular kind of shade of muscle movement. That's intention. She thinks this is a bad way to go. The other way is to look at the interior, go the psychological. Well, it's not the physical, obviously not the physical, can't be the physical, not molecules or muscles. It's got to be some psychological state, right? It's my intending to move my, raise my hand is like my, you know, thinking about it and like psychologizing it, okay? Good. She says, it's really not at all to be wondered that very so many people have thought of intention as a special interior movement. And that doesn't mean like just like pushing kind of stuff, chemicals, but like an interior movement. Like, I want to raise my hand. I'm going to raise my hand. Cool, let's raise it. Yes, we're hooked up. You know, good to go. Okay? So there's no surprise this is a very common way of doing this. Right? But Chisholm does. Okay? But then the thing that marked this man's proceedings as intentional poisoning of these people would just be this interior movement occurred in him. Now you say, wait a minute, poisoning? What's the poisoning here? This is because she gives an example of, she says, let's just stop theorizing for a moment. And let's look at a concrete example. Okay? This is very famous. The whole book is kind of working out this example, which I've tried to recreate here. Say you've got a man, and he's pumping water. And that water is going to a cistern outside a house. It supplies water to the house. Okay? And then so that's where the water. So he's just up there pumping water back and forth. Now, let's add some complications to it. Say, well, there's a toad, obviously. Obviously, there's going to be a toad around. I expect. She doesn't say it's there, but I know it's there. Okay. They like water pumping. Okay. She says, now imagine that someone has poison, like has put poison into the piping that goes from the water, from the pump, to the cistern that then go to the house. It's poison the water, right? And then imagine that this house is a place where state officials of some, now she wrote this, some state officials who are for a government that's very corrupt and is planning to do very bad things, right? And they meet there, okay? So what happens is the water is pumped and goes to the cistern and then it poisons the people, right? Okay, that's what's happening. Man is pumping water to the house, it's poisoned, and the people in it are being killed by this poison, okay? In the background, you have to know that what Anscombe is doing is, this is an example, I take it, is supposed to serve as doing duty for another example. In the 40s, there's a man not pumping, but moving his hand up and down on a piece of paper that is causing generals to send orders to planes that are carrying a large nuclear weapon that then is dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The question is, what is that man in the first part, the pumper or the pen signer, what is he doing? Why does this matter? Take a quick diversion. We're not breaking out of the ABC chain, okay? But quick diversion. Why Anscombe? One of the things that Anscombe really starts writing all these things, or why she's so excited about this, is because in 56, Oxford decided to give Truman an honorary degree, an honor, and she thought that's like giving an honorary degree to a mass murderer, right? And so she proposed, and there's a book on this, by the way, with a bunch of other female scholars there, though she's the kind of ringleader of this in Somerville. The book's called The Women Are All Up to Something by Benjamin Lipscomb. So that's Anscombe, and then Iris Murdoch, I think, and then Midgley and Philippa Foote, okay, the four of them. And she writes this pamphlet called Mr. Truman's Degree against saying we can't honor this man because the only reason we can honor him is because he's a mass murderer, right? And everyone else is like, you're nuts. He stopped tons of people from dying. But you already get a sense that she's not interested in that kind of justification of moral terms, right? So she says, the action was necessary. At any rate, it was thought to be by competent expert, the dropping of a nuclear bomb. This is in Mr. Truman's Degree. To be necessary, it probably saved more lives than it sacrificed. It had good results. It ended the war. This is the interlocutor, right? She's then speaking to the interlocutor against her. Come now, if you had to choose between boiling one baby and letting some frightful disaster befall 1,000 people, or 1,000,000 people, 1,000 is not enough, what would you do? Are you going to strike an attitude and say, you may not do evil, that good may come? Right? Her point is, well, I hope that that's not striking an attitude. That's just thinking morally. But she's concerned that we've lost the ability to do that, and so we're going to, one of the symptoms of modern moral philosophy is we're giving degrees to Truman, which we shouldn't be doing for her, right? She says, when she's protesting in Oxford, she says, I informed the senior proctor of my intention to oppose Mr. Truman's degree. He consulted with the registrar to get me informed on procedure. Oxford. Okay, good. The vice chancellor was informed. I was cautiously asked if I had got up a party. I had not, but a fine house was whipped up to vote for the honor. So there's people, like, voting on this thing here. The dons at St. John's were simply told, the women are up to something in convocation. They're going to vote about this degree. We have to go and vote them down. Right? And later she says, I kind of like St. John's. You know, that's nice. Yeah, good for them. You know? Okay? And then she says, so he's going to get the degree. And she says, the censor of St. Catherine's in charge of this degree had an odious task. He must make a speech. which should pretend to show that a couple of massacres, to a man's credit, are not exactly a reason for not showing him honor, right? I mean, no one's perfect, right? Couple massacres. No, who am I to judge? Okay, you've done bad things, right? You probably stole something from a kid, okay? He had, one great advantage. He did not have to persuade his audience, who were already perfectly convinced of the proposition. But at any rate, he had to make a show of it. The defense, I think, would not have been well received at Nuremberg, okay? She's a baller, right? She's not fooling around, okay? That's Anscombe. That's the woman who was like, you know, he was really good at giving good book what to read. You know, that's her, right? You guys, you would defend Hitler, wouldn't you, with this, right? It works the same way, like, oh my gosh, but I mean, like, the roads, you know, everyone, no one's perfect. No one's perfect. Hitler gets the... Okay, right, that's... Right, okay. All right. There's also that none of these philosophers... This is modern moral philosophy, right? None of these philosophers... This is the quote that Dr. Bierson told us. Displays any conscience there is such an ethic of absolute norms. You have this. There's no one making these absolute norm claims. Which is pretty well taken for obvious among them that all the prohibitions, such as that murder, does not operate in the face of some consequences. But of course, the strictness of that prohibition, you shouldn't murder, except... has its point that you are not to be tempted by fear or hope of consequences. This is pointing out, like, look, obviously we're against murder, most moral philosophers at the time. But, like, remember, that prohibition is only... Well, let's not strike an attitude, okay? All right, so back to this. So that's in the back. You have to hear me this in the background. This is real. This isn't just random philosophy. This is like a lot of people died. A ton of people, innocent people died. Because people did not understand what action and moral theory is. Or at least it would help if they did. Or at least he wouldn't get a degree for killing all these people. Okay, so the question is, she wants to know, remember, we're looking for the action description. What is the description of this action? Because then we can judge whether it's moral or not. We need to find the description. So, what's happening here? Well, she says, there are arm movements. Man's arm goes up and down. Up and down. She's a great writer in some ways. A horrible right if you want to understand her. But that's some nice turns of phrase that you can see. Just up and down. And then she repeats it. Up and down. You're like, woo, that I like that. Okay. So there's arm movements here, right? There's also substance generation. It says, like, in his muscles, there's substances being generated. Some chemistry majors here. Stuff's happening. Okay? That's what's happening here. Okay? That's a description of the action. There's casting shadows. You know, he's casting shadows on the ground because the sun's out and he's doing his pumping thing, right? There's beating out a rhythm. Turns out, like, his rhythm is actually kind of beating out a sort of song. Toad's happy about that, right? He's kind of, like, humming along to it. He's replenishing a cistern. Putting water in a cistern again. Right? That's what he's up to. Yeah, that's a description, right? He's poisoning some state officials. Oh, cool, yeah, he's doing that. That's what's happening here, right? Oh, he's putting good men in power. Right? I mean, that they're gonna... The state government is gonna die, so we're gonna have... He's putting good men in power, right? He's bringing about the kingdom of God. Right? Just pumping up and down, right? And you ask yourself, let us ask, is there any description which is the description of intentional action, given that intentional action occurs? There is, we can assume, let's take for granted, this man knows what he's up to. Like, he's doing something. You don't go, what are you doing? He goes, I'm just here. I don't know what's happening. Like, he's doing something. What is the one thing he's doing? All right? Because then if we can target that, then we can figure out, well, look, if it's putting good men in power... That's what he's up to, really. That's really what he's doing. Well, the other ones don't matter. We can weigh off these things, right? Sure, he's poisoning state officials, right? But putting good men in power is higher. This is the Morian kind of calculus, right? That's higher than this, right? So what is the? If we can get the real description of this thing, then we can sort this out, right? And where would you go? Which one of these is not the real description? How do you figure this out? Do you look at it with a microscope somewhere out there, like, or a telescope? Or do you, like, go to the Freudian couch and figure out what's he thinking about? Where do we get this good intention from? Remember, we need it. We're not going to be able to figure out what human action is without figuring out where this darn thing is. Okay? Well, why do we say, she's raised some questions about trying to decide. You say, okay, what's one of these things, right? It's not pumping the water, it's killing the officials. But why do we say that the movement of the pump handle up and down is part of a process whereby those people cease to move about, right? That's moving up and down and you're moving the handle, and they're ceasing to move after a certain period of time drinking water, right? Okay. It is part of a causal chain, which ends with the households getting poisoned. You might think, oh, well, it's poisoning because it's this thing. Causal chain, right? But then, so is some turn of a wheel of a train by which one of the inhabitants traveled to the house. That's causally involved in him not moving anymore. If that wheel didn't turn, he wouldn't have got to that house, and he wouldn't have been poisoned. So that's a part of this, too. If you're looking for that thing out there, right? If you're looking for that physical thing out there, why was the movement of the pump handle a more important position than the turn of the wheel? Right? If it's the physical thing, remember? For after all, we can form intentions. Now, if intention was an interior movement, now let's go to this. Well, maybe it's something an interior thing. What interiorly we pick out which of these action descriptions are right. It would appear that we can choose to have a certain intention and not another. All right? Just by saying within ourselves, what I mean to be doing is earning my living and not poisoning the households. And you ask this man, what are you doing? He says, hold on a second, let me do it. I am earning a living, not poisoning the household. Right? Physically, remember, it's not physical. It's an interior emotion, right? It's a psychological thing. So if that's true, then I can, like, intend not to... I might poison them, but I'm not intending it. I'm just thinking about making a living, right? What I mean to be doing is helping those good men into power. That's what I'm doing. I can pick which of those action descriptions is the action description by my choice, of my thought, right? I withdraw my intention from the act of poisoning the household, which I prefer to think goes on without my intention being in it. Bypasses. The idea, she says, that one can determine one's intentions by making a little speech to oneself, like this. And this is how we intend actions, right? We have a little speech that goes on, a little dialogue for me. Now, she says, this is insane, too. This can't be right, right? Because what's the end of that, you know? I'm intending to move a bunch of people from here to there, but there's like, fire between there. Not my problem. Not intending to burn them. Just intending to move them from point A to point B, right? That's, and you can't tell me what my intention is. Only I know that. I think, okay, that's her problem there, right? So, he says, like, imagine this. This is what I call the intentional saxophonist, right? So imagine someone playing a saxophone, human action, I take it, right? It's not like a body that's hooked up to some sort of, we're not doing weird analytic philosophy examples, okay? This is just a standard Dr. Beerson just gets his alto sax, that's tenor sax, bigger. Tenor saxophone, and it just starts playing, right? We can assume that you're a saxophonist, right? You're playing saxophone. It's a human action. Now ask yourself this question. Well, what makes it an intentional one? Like, what's the difference between a mere saxophonist, someone who's just playing, it's a human action, and then one who's an intentional saxophonist? Like, what if we take out the intention of playing the saxophone? Then we just have a mere saxophonist, right? So, it's the same guy, but it's just, this is the Raising the Arm example, right? And you might think, like, what is it? Wait, so is he playing that saxophone intentionally? Or is he just playing it? Like, maybe he's just playing saxophone, not playing intention. And if it's intentionally, then it looks like this, right? It's a sort of glow, right? Still the saxophone guy, but he's now an intentional saxophonist, right? Because these look the same, and that can't be right. Right? And the intention has got to be something different than playing the saxophone. It's got to be intending to play the saxophone, right? So it's got to be this guy, the intentional saxophonist. And now all we're doing is trying to figure out, where is that glow? Where is the intending in this sort of thing, right? This is going to be a bad way, because we've tried to find where this would be, and we can't, okay? What Anscombe says is, we do not add anything attaching to the action at the time it is done by describing it as intentional. It says, look, if you're describing a saxophonist, intentional saxophonist, and then you add intention, like, here's a saxophonist, but he's an intentional one, right, let me add that in. Yes, he's an intentional, what did I do? He says, nothing. You haven't done anything, right? It would be weird to think that you had. Were you intending to play the saxophone? No, but I'll start intending now, right? You can intend to play a certain piece, but playing the saxophone isn't like something that comes unintentionally, I take it, right? To call it intentional is to assign it to a class of intentional actions, so indicate that we should consider the question why, relevant in the sense that I have described. Now, Dr. Pearson's going to help us on this. This is a bit of her problem, what she does think intention is, right? Okay. Now, interestingly enough, Anscombe says that in this, she has stumbled upon what she takes to be Aristotle's view of action. So, in her account of ethics, right, any kind of intention. She says, I did not realize the identity of my view with Aristotle until I had reached my results, which we're not hearing yet. For the starting points for my inquiry were different from Aristotle's. As is natural for someone writing in a different time. I love that. As you will, I mean, you know, they're different people, right? You know, sort of thing. Right, perfect. Thanks for adding that. Okay, it's great. Well, in a way, my own constructions are artificial as Aristotle's for a series of questions why, such as I described, but the appropriate answers cannot occur very often. What Anscombe says is, look, I looked at a bunch of moral philosophers, and they're getting the wrong answers. They're awarding degrees to mass murderers. I've got to figure out what's going on here. It's because they don't understand action correctly. And part of the reason they don't understand action correctly is because they're asking modern action questions, which are asking the question of, what is that other thing that you add called intention to normal human actions that make them intentional actions? Like, what is that thing that you add to someone playing the saxophone that makes it intentionally playing the saxophone? And she says, this is a mistake to think about this. And then she works out, to her next, her answer to what she thinks is going on. And she says, I didn't notice this first, but I have actually discovered that this is how Aristotle thinks about this. Which shouldn't surprise us if we remember the lesson of the law conception of ethics that adds a new piece to something that Aristotle isn't aware of. So when she works out her theory, she thinks that she's meeting Aristotle on his own ground and thinks that Aristotle is the person we want to look to sort out intentions and actions. So, in conclusion, what we have here is not yet a solution. Of course we don't. But we should feel confident, now I hope, that the question she asked at the very start, what is the one description, and therefore where do we find it and how do we get it, was a misplaced question in the first place. But we're left not knowing what to do because it seems like we still have a notion of intentional action. It seems like I still do intend things. So where do we go from here? And that's the next talk with Dr. Beerson sorting us out on what is the right question to ask about intentional actions. Once we can answer that, what is the right question about intentional actions, then we'll know something about human actions. And once we know about something about human actions, then we're in the space of whether those actions are moral or not. But I'll leave that to Dr. Beerson to get me set up for that fourth talk. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.